It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored digital radio around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com, on the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course on the beloved NSN app. With us live via telephone from Israel is our good friend Rabbi Stephen Przanski. It's been a while since Rabbi Przanski has been with us on the air, and this morning I'm very anxious to speak with him because of what today is, and we'll remind you about that in a moment. Rabbi Przanski, of course, is Rabbi Emeritus of Congregation B'nai Yeshurun here in Teaneck, New Jersey. At one time, the rabbi of the largest congregation here in Teaneck. He is the Vice President, Israel Region of the Coalition for Jewish Values and Senior Research Associate at the Jerusalem Center for Applied Policy. I asked Rabbi Przanski to join me because of what I went through 30 years ago. September the 13th, 1993, I honestly remember sitting in my office and watching what was going on the White House lawn. The Oslo Accords were being signed, and I remember Mayor Weingarten of blessed memory and I were on the phone together just saying to each other, this just doesn't feel right. There's something that just doesn't feel right. And Rabbi Przanski was pretty outspoken at the time, and I don't think he's ever stopped voicing the opinion that we could have done without the Oslo Accords. He's with us live via telephone. Rabbi Przanski, I take this opportunity to wish you a happy, healthy, and sweet new year and say welcome back to JM in the AM.
Nahum, it's great to be with you, and thank you for the reminder. Mazel tov on the 40th anniversary of JM in the AM. You've inspired so many Jews over the years, and I could say without any hesitation at all that your 40th anniversary is much more meaningful to the Jewish people for what you accomplished for the Jewish people than the 30th anniversary of the signing of the Oslo Accords. All right, it's a low bar, but...
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure if I should take that as a compliment or not, but boy, how right you are, unfortunately. For us, the Jewish people. And I remember seriously where I was watching the ceremony. Do you remember where you were 30 years ago today?
Yeah, I was probably in my law office at the time. And it was pretty depressing. The feeling that you and Mayor had, I had, and was shared by many others as well at the time, it just didn't make any sense. I mean, to bring your enemy into your heartland, give them territory, weapons and money, well, what could go wrong with that? Yeah. And it's the euphoria of the time, which was based on the most unrealistic expectations that human behavior can change overnight, that it was impossible to stop that galloping train. And the consequences for Israeli society have been ominous in any number of ways, and we still feel the after effects. I mean, obviously the terror still exists and has only grown over the years, but I think one lingering aspect that people don't think about that often, it was the first time that the Israeli government put its name on a paper that said that the Jewish people do not have the right to the land of Israel. Wow. In whole or in part. And think about it, it's 30 years, you have a whole generation of Jews in Israel and in America that have been raised thinking that, well, why are they there if they have agreed that the land really belongs to the Palestinians, at least on some level? Why are they there? So the narrative of occupation grew as a result of Oslo. Instead of what the Israeli government of the time thought, that it would lead to acceptance and recognition of Israel, the land of Israel, the state of Israel, within recognized borders. The exact opposite happened. So that is an educational malpractice that has been very hard to undo.
Oh, so true. Rabbi Stephen Przanski is with us. You know, and there's so many levels to this, and you spoke just a moment ago or alluded to the frailty of human behavior, the frailty of human, I guess, in a way, you know, the hope of humanity. You wish things were a certain way. We see that in this country right now where, you know, there are certain cities that are crime ridden and the leaders of those cities, you know, get on the broadcast and tell everybody how, you know, crime continues to diminish in their area. And it's just like they don't want to address the real issue. And I think to a degree, and I'm sure you agree with this, the people negotiating Oslo or who dreamt of Oslo, who were in Israel, The biggest problem is, and the Abraham Accords, of course, proved all this, the biggest problem is there was never a responsible peace partner. There was never a responsible person or organization on the other side that legitimately wanted peace and that one can negotiate a real peace agreement with. And I think that that was one of the first great illusions of the Oslo process was that they made believe that the person and people on the other side of the table were as anxious for peace as they were.
Right. One of the more execrable cliches of the time was that you make peace with your enemy, not with your friend. Well, that is partially true. The fact is you make peace with your enemy who wants to be your friend,
right,
not peace with your enemy who still wants to be your enemy. And it's the delusional aspects of Oslo that really border on the pathological. Just a few weeks after Oslo, the first victims of terror were killed in the land of Israel. In Batsra, there was a suicide bombing a month after Oslo, but nothing could dissuade them. You recall another unfortunate cliche that Shimon Peres used to use, sacrifices for peace. Right. Anyone who died as a result of terror, there were sacrifices for peace. Just 4 months after Oslo, and the accords were signed, January 1994, Arafat spoke to Arab diplomats in Stockholm, and it was recorded and it was publicized just a few weeks after that, in which he said this is similar to the Treaty of Quraysh that Muhammad had signed with the Jewish tribes in the Arabian Peninsula, a temporary peace for the purpose of weakening them and then destroying them, which is what happened to the tribe of Quraysh. So he did not see this as the ultimate reconciliation and peace. He saw it as a way, literally, to get a foothold in the land of Israel, bring in his terror crew, and continue his nefarious and murderous ways. The fact that Israel knew this, the fact that I knew it, but the fact that the Israeli government knew it, and didn't say, whoa, what are we talking about? Why are we accommodating him? Why are we trying to tell our public that Arafat just has to speak that language in Arabic to his people, and he doesn't really mean it? What he really means is that he's a person of peace. It's pathological. You know, last week I saw on television, they showed a clip of one of Rabin's granddaughters. I think her name was Noah Filosof, being interviewed in the late 90s, early 2000s, and she said of Arafat, he was like a Dod Hamud, like a dear uncle, a cute uncle who would come to our home all the time and he would play with us and he was so amicable, so friendly. This guy was a mass murderer of Jews and others. He has the blood of thousands of Jews on his hands. But the extent of the delusion was that suddenly he's transformed in the eyes of the left to a Dod Hamud, to some cute uncle. And one of the things that we're pondering here in Israel these days, you know, there's never a dull moment in Israel, which is all part of the process of redemption, is that the parents of the founders of Oslo, at least their ideological parents, are those who brought upon us the debacle of the Yom Kippur War, whose 50th anniversary is next week.
Right.
And it's the children, the spiritual children, the ideological children of the Oslo founders who are now taking the streets in order to essentially overthrow the Israeli government and turn Israel's Supreme Court into a judicial dictatorship because the people have spoken. Oslo turned off a large percentage of the Israeli population. One reason why the two-state illusion is a dead letter, even the left doesn't speak about it. But the fact is the people vote, and they voted for right-wing government after right-wing government. Not that it's always governed as a right-wing government, but the only remnant they have of their privileged elite status is the Supreme Court, an undemocratic Supreme Court, and that's why they do not want to tamper or allow the Knesset to tamper with its methodology of judgment and certainly not its composition. Because if they do that, then they've lost everything. So that's the bitter irony that we're living through today.
Well,
it also has part of the after effects of the Oslo Accords, that the only way to retain Israel as a democracy is to have this undemocratic institution essentially rule on everything that happens in the society.
But I still would not argue that they would, that it's the only thing they have left and that they'd lose everything if they lost this. Because frankly, when you have the media on your side the way they do at this point, and that really hasn't changed much. I mean, you, some might say it's changed a little bit over the last few years, but it hasn't changed much. I mean, when you have the media these days, you basically have it all. I mean, I get it. The judicial system.
Very powerful. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Very powerful because the media controls the narrative. But I was talking about the governmental institutions.
Right. No, I get that. I get that, and I appreciate that. All right, Stephen Brzezinski with us live via telephone. Now, you've said this publicly, but I'm curious about some of the details. You made it well known, as I said, you had one of the world's largest congregations here in New Jersey, and obviously a congregation very concerned about Israel. And you made it well known, I don't know when, but certainly everyone knows it now. That members of the Israeli government, consulate, representatives in America, you could tell us details to the degree that you wish, tried to convince you and others who are coming out in leadership roles against the Oslo Accords to temper your criticism of the Oslo Accords. I'm curious, September the 13th is the White House ceremony. In July, a lot of people didn't even realize outside of Jerusalem's, you know, secret hideouts that these negotiations were going on. So when did this happen? Was it in August before? 40 officials signing that some officials tried to dissuade you from speaking out against the Accords?
No, the first word that we got of anything that was happening was in August, the end of August, when the negotiations that were taking place in secrecy, and by the way, in defiance of Israeli law, which at the time prohibited meetings with PLO officials, then we got word of something going on, and the process really unfolded very, very quickly. I was still in Queens, by the way, at the time, in Kew Gardens Hills. I remember late September 93, maybe early October, Itamar Rabinovich came to speak in the Young Israel of Kew Gardens Hills. And it was a very raucous crowd. You know, Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, of blessed memory, he was another outspoken opponent of Oslo. And to my horror, I must say, someone threw a tomato at Ambassador Rabinovich. In the middle of the shul, it missed him, hit the Aron HaKodesh. And there's a little bedlam. I remember someone got up and said to Rabinovich, who was trying to extol the virtues of the Accords, that this is worse than Chamberlain, worse than the appeasement at Munich. And I stood up, and I actually raised my hand. I didn't yell out. Uh-huh. And I said to the fellow who said this in the audience, you know, Rabbi, I really must disagree with you. Because Chamberlain gave away Czechoslovakia to the Germans. He didn't give away part of England and say he's going to give half of Yerushalayim in the future. So this is the half of London in the future.
Right.
So actually this was a worse appeasement than was. So I wrote some articles about it. I spoke about it. And then the consulate called us in, maybe 10, 12 rabbis, to try to moderate our opposition. And I remember quite vividly, the speaker was Gad Ben-Ari, who at the time was the press attaché to Prime Minister Rabin. And he could not speak in more flowery language of the era of peace that was upon us. You know, you could just see the angels floating in the sky and holding hands with, you know, terrorists and taking away their Kalashnikovs and their bombs, and everyone is happy and everyone is a kumbaya. And I asked him a few questions, and this again shows the extent to which they were given over to this mania. I asked him that short of Arafat planting a bomb in the Knesset and blowing it up, how will you define, what is the metric whether the Accords are a failure success, because that would seem to be a failure. And he said to me, no, even if that happened, it would not be a failure, because by definition, a process can never fail. It's always a process. And that's why they named it the Oslo process or the peace process.
Right.
It's always just a little ahead. You know, like the plastic dog at the racetrack. You can't ever get it, but it's always something that, not that I would know about that, by the way.
What is wrong with us? What is wrong with us? I ask over over and over. It's unbelievable. I don't even know what to say. And I grew up in a home. I mean, I would never, certainly publicly, I would never criticize Menachem Begin. He was a hero to so many of us. I grew up in a home that was very, very pro-Begin, but frankly, against Camp David. I mean, this is the reality. This was my father's position on the matter, thought it was a terrible idea. And again, you know, I've debated with I don't know how many people, including in the Orthodox world, including in the right-wing political Orthodox religiously world, so many of whom have pointed out, you know, look at the peace agreement that Camp David spawned with Egypt. I mean, it just, the incredible, you know, the lives that weren't lost because of it. But it is hard not to believe that episode of the Camp David Accords was not the precursor for Oslo. In fact, today on Wikipedia, I didn't even realize this, they actually described the framework of the Oslo Agreement to be based on the framework of the agreement with Egypt. So, you know, as much as we would like to, and I know that you and I might be criticized because we're definitively coming out against Oslo, and some might argue there are some positive points to it. As much as people love to come out pro Camp David, this might be, do you agree, this might be one of the drawbacks of that agreement.
I do agree. I think Begin's approach was to take the largest Arab country out of the anti-Israel mix, in the hope that having diffused that country's aggressiveness, it might pave the way for other agreements or make a much more unlikely. The problem I had with it, both at the time and in retrospect, is this whole notion of land for peace.
Right.
Land for peace is a concoction specifically for Israel and its neighbors. It's applied nowhere else in the world and no other time in history that you reward the aggressor who was defeated with the land that he used as a launching pad in order to attack you. It's never happened before. It's never happened since. And there's a good reason for it. All you do is incentivize aggression. Well, how have the Camp David Accords worked out? The truth is it's 45 years since they were signed, and Egypt has gone from pro or friendly to Israel to cold to Israel, to hostile to Israel. And now there's an important alliance between Israel and Egypt that I hope continues. But when I look at the Camp David Accords, which actually had many more positive ramifications than did the Oslo Accords, I think of something that Henry Kissinger wrote in one of his books. He was sitting with the Chinese Prime Minister, Chou Enlai, and he asked Cho, what are the long-term consequences of the French Revolution, 1790s?
Right.
So now you're talking about 180 years after that.
Right.
And Chou Enlai responded, it's too early to tell.
Oof.
Okay?
Yep.
It's the same thing with the Camp David Accord. So halavai, you continue with peace, with alliances, with shared interests, which now exists with Egypt, but you can never tell down the road what's going to happen. And especially considering that the Arab world is a little volatile,
right,
to use an understatement.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to mention about this meeting at the consul with Gad Ben-Ari, I said to him, what logic does it make to bring your enemy into your heartland and give them weapons? You're rendering your defenses vulnerable. And he said to me in these words, which I'll never forget, if there's peace, why do we need a defense? And that was the mindset. That's how much they were obsessed with this notion that a new world was upon us and a new Middle East. Paris spoke at the time that Gaza is going to be like Singapore. No, it didn't happen.
Really?
He should be held to account for it. I mean, take away the Nobel Peace Prize. Do something. Gaza is not Singapore. Gaza is a haven for terror and a place of tremendous misery for the people who live there, the Arabs who live there, much less as a base to threaten all of Israel. People who are so bright can be so wrong when their minds are made up and are not subject to the mitigation of facts and reality.
And like I said, and we have a million examples of that today on both sides of the world. So it's not like it's such a foreign concept to everybody. People make things up based on either their own realities or they want the way they want their reality to be. You know, one other thing we have to point out that is so vital and important. I mean, you alluded to it earlier because you were speaking of the immediate terror attacks that took place after Oslo was signed, and obviously those are significant, and we need to remember all the victims. But in addition to that, there was a period of time, you remember it, you remember it very well. There was a period of time over a period of years where the massive terror attack was a daily occurrence. And those who think I'm exaggerating, you know, it may not be daily, but boy, it was close to it. Sometimes multiple attacks in days. I'm talking about bus bombings and multiple murders, and you know, the taking of lives on during holidays and through episodes that took, you know, tens of people at a time, and you know, and all of that. You know, those of us who remember, that was years after Oslo was signed, years later. So if any,
there was a great spurt of terror in 1996, which led to the election of Benjamin Netanyahu for the first time.
Right.
And of course, what you're referring to is the major wave of terror in 2001 and 2002, right, where there were daily and weekly attacks on Jews, suicide bombings, you know, Sbarro Pizza and the discotheque in Tel Aviv and on a Cafe Hillel.
And Seder Night.
Seder Night, the Park Hotel in Netanya, on and on and on. And the attitude was amongst the Israeli establishment at the time, well, there's no military solution. So they were wrong about that also. It turned out there was a military solution. And when the Operation Protective Shield began in Jenin in 2003, within a few months, the terror had stopped almost completely because, once again, Israel was able to patrol in the Arab towns and villages and thwart the terror. And that was very critical to having some type of relative serenity in the land of Israel.
Yeah, no question about that. All right, Stephen Brzezinski is with us. We're talking about the 30th anniversary of Oslo. By the way, you know, we're talking about, you know, one thing leading to another. Would you argue, as I tend to do, that the 2005 Gaza disengagement was yet another chapter of this unrealistic expectations that, you know, were so prevalent during the Oslo Accords?
It took it to the next level, and it was carried out, of course, by a former Likudnik who had left his party because the Likud membership voted against it. And yeah, look, there were at the time some personal considerations that he had. He was about to be indicted, and he was able to preclude the indictment by going down this unfortunate road. But no doubt one thing led to another, and that itself has had very, very harmful consequences to Israel. One other thing that's important to point out on the anniversary is that Oslo passed with a minority of Jews in the Knesset voting for it. Meaning one of the accords passed 61-59, and the Jewish vote was 59 against and like 50 in favor. So all those people who speak today about making narrow decisions in the Knesset on judicial reform, 64-46, by the way, if you're only counting the Jews in the Knesset, 64-56 on if you count the Arab opposition members, well, it's a greater majority now than it was then. Mm-hmm. But no one said then that, well, you can't pass these accords with such a narrow majority, it's going to upset the whole population. No, I remember Yitzhak Rabin saying openly, explicitly, about those who opposed Oslo, they can spin like propellers. He doesn't care what they have to say. He had no hesitation in ramming through the vote on a very narrow basis, with most Knesset members who are Jews voting against it simply because he had committed himself to that policy. So all the talk today about having narrow votes in the Knesset, it's all bogus. It's all narrative. It's all media spin of those who are opposed to the current legislation.
One other thing we should mention, by the way, in addition to Gaza and the terror attacks and the waves of terror that we talked about and other things that were a result of Oslo, people forget we were this close to losing a significant portion of Jerusalem. We were this close, if not for Arafat's stubbornness, frankly. You know, God knows what...
You're talking about Ehud Barak, somehow has revived himself in the last few months. He offered Arafat the Har HaBayit, the Kotel, half of Yerushalayim, almost all of Yudan Shomron, all of Gaza, and including some other land in the Negev, and Arafat still said no.
Unbelievable.
Still said no. So right.
We have him
to the chagrin of Bill Clinton. But I also recall vividly one of the Arabists in the State Department, who's now an ambassador, Robert Malley, saying at the time, hey, it's not only Arafat, it's the Israelis also. Oh, what do the Israelis do? Well, he couldn't say. But even the anti-Israel figures in the State Department, they didn't become any more pro-Israel as a result of Oslo. They still harbored this negativity.
Understood. But by the way, there's something to all that, and as silly as it might sound, because frankly, you know, world Jewry, those who live in Israel and those who live outside of Israel, should always have been, no matter what level they were, should always have been even more outspoken about our love for and our desperation to keep Jerusalem.
Yes. I don't doubt that at all. I mean, Yerushalayim is the city of all Jews. It's the spiritual center of the Jewish people. Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, is Har HaBayit. Yeah, I wish Jews took a greater interest. And even looking back at that time and comparing it to today, I think it's important that Jews not just accept what the government or the opposition in this particular case says at face value. You have to look beneath the spin, beneath the politics, and think, what is in the greater interest of Klal Yisrael, of the Jewish people? What furthers Israel as a Jewish state? What could bring the redemption closer? That's what we should be focused on. And if we do that, and especially Jews in the Galut, they look at Israel that way, and not just, you know, as the Disney World to visit, and again, a week or two of spiritual experiences, and then go back. No, because this is the future of all of Klal Yisrael. Everyone will be here someday, we hope. And therefore, it's not just interest, but people should wake up in the morning thinking what they can do to strengthen the land and the people of Israel. A lot of Jews do that. I mean, obviously, you're one of them, but a lot of Jews do that. Their passion is the state of Israel, the land of Israel, the people of Israel. But we need many more Jews to take that interest and be a little less complacent.
Oh, so true. The future of the Jewish people is in the state of Israel. Can't say it enough times. Rabbi Stephen Przanski, love your clarity. Always have and always will. I thank you so much for joining us. And I wish, and I convey to you and your family, a happy, healthy, sweet new year. Enjoy 5784 in the Holy Land.
Amen. Nachum to you, your family, and all your listeners. Ktiva v'chatima tova.
Toda rabba. There he is, Rabbi Stephen Przanski, on this 30th anniversary of Oslo here at JM in the AM.